We discussed in the last lecture the three frontier characteristics that Richard Eaton mentions in the context of Bengal Delta, the political, agrarian, and religious ones. River dynamics remained at the center of discussion while we were discussing the three frontiers, especially the changing course of the Ganga in Bengal. But there is one hypothesis which is so very relevant for our area of study, and that hypothesis has been given by Victor Lieberman in his two volumes called Strange Parallels. Victor Lieberman uses the terms like exposed zones and protected zones. He uses exposed zones for the mainland territories such as the Indo-Gangetic zone of South Asia, in contrast to the protected zones of Eurasia and Japan. The protected zones, according to him, were located at a distance from Central Asia, which was sufficient to avoid invasion by the nomads. On the other hand, he has used another term called exposed zones, wherein you have many of the South Asian regions which were repeatedly invaded by the Turkic and Mongol nomads. So the arrival of the Turks on horseback does suggest that the invasion of exposed agrarian region of India. And in that sense, Lieberman's hypothesis of, you know, India being an exposed zone is, it appears to be correct. And obviously when we have these evidences of Turkic invaders like Bakhtiar Khalji, who invaded the entire territory right from the mid-Ganga area and then settled into lower Ganga basin in Bengal. So then, you know, then it suggests that, and it appears that Victor Lieberman's hypothesis of exposed zones is correct. But one question that remains unanswered, while we as history researchers try to deal with the early history of Delhi Sultans, and that is, why Bakhtiar Khalji preferred to rule from Bengal and then kept himself away from the mid-Ganga basin. But before we discuss about the very reason why rulers or the Turkic invaders, they preferred Bengal Delta instead of mid-Ganga area, let us try to understand the two terminologies of protected zones and exposed zones. So as I mentioned that Victor Lieberman talks about the exposed zones, and he gives example of Europe, Eurasia, and Japan. He says that and now, of course, he also mentions about the mainland Southeast Asia, which includes regions of Korea, Bhutan, and then he also includes one of the regions of India, that is Assam. He says that all these regions are basically, they constitute the protected zones. And these protected zones, he compares them with the regions whose political history for much of the second millennium was shaped by actors generally, you know, the inner Asians, the Mongols, who originated outside the regions of India, right? So when he's talking about these exposed zones, he's mentioning that India is an exposed zone wherein you have the outsiders who are the inner Asians, like the Mongols, who invaded these territories, or the Turks. They invaded the territory because it was in an exposed position. However, when he talks about these two zones, the protected ones and the exposed zones, he first of all gives us that what are the similarities between the two zones. He mentions that the same basic forces which promoted the integration in the protected zones of Eurasia, Japan, and Southeast Asia. For example, he says that the forces like population growth, the population like the forces like the agrarian expansion, or for that matter, the European style of firearms. And then he also mentions about the local and long distance trade. Then he mentions about forces such as the wider literacy, the military competition. Now, all this, and along with the technical expertise, Victor Lieberman says that it encourages the integration in those territories. He then says that if you look at South Asia, movements of political and cultural integration were far more limited and fragile than what you find in China. Then Lieberman surveys extensively the South Asian empires such as the Mauryas, the Guptas, even the Delhi Sultanate, the Mughals, the Bengal Sultanate, even the British. And he finds that the intervals between successive empires, it tended to grow shorter, especially if we start our calculation with the collapse of the Guptas in the mid 500s. So, you know, if you look at from 6th century AD onwards, he says that, you know, the intervals between these successive empires, it became shorter and shorter. So that's why, you know, after the Guptas, it took longer for the Delhi Sultanate to get established, but then it took a little shorter for the Delhi Sultanate being replaced by the Mughals, and even much shorter time was taken by the British. So that is to suggest that the longest era of polycentrism followed the Gupta collapse, which is, and then you have the, you know, the a long gap from after the Gupta collapse, between the Gupta collapse and the establishment of the Delhi Sultanate. But if you look at the next gap, the next transition, you have the decline of the Delhi Sultanate happening around 14th century. And then you have a shorter period of what Lieberman calls as polycentrism, which lay between the collapse of the Mughals and then the next transition that we find is the founding of the British Empire. So as periods of imperial collapse grew shorter, the successive empires secured larger sectors of subcontinent. So when the imperial collapse is, you know, the gap between two imperial powers is getting shorter as we move on, but the size of these empires is actually growing, right? So you have a Delhi Sultanate much bigger than the Guptas, and then the Mughals have much bigger territory than the Delhi Sultanate, and then the British have even greater territory than the Mughals. So what has happened that the symptoms and the cause of imperial stability was the enhanced efficiency of military and physical organization. And it happened with changes which is actually particularly taking shape in the 15th century, or for that matter in the 16th century, or for that matter in the 18th century. So when the empires became more stable, it is largely because of the more enhancement of the military power. Like for that matter in the 13th century, you see the Delhi Sultanate becoming much more stable because of the expansion of the Delhi Sultanate army under Alauddin Khilji. And then in 16th century, under Akbar, you have the expansion and many of the systems like the Mansab system and the Jagir system coming into play. And then, you know, the imperial power is becoming much more stronger. Similarly, in, you know, what happens after the establishment of the British rule is that it is in the 19th century that you find that the British have become much more powerful. So the southward diffusion, according to Liberman, is actually, and when he's talking about the southward expansion, he's talking about the Perso-Islamic culture. So initially it was the Sanskritic culture which was spreading, diffusing. Then he says that when the Perso-Islamic culture came, it then spread to different parts of India. Then he talks about, Liberman also speaks about the post-1700 slowdown that had more in common with Japan than with Europe or Southeast Asia. And he speaks about the long-term economic trends that has taken shape in South Asia, including the expansion that has taken place, that is happening between 900 and 1300, and then in the next stage between 15th century and the 18th century. So he says that the economic and technical spurs, the technical knowledge was very important in the political integration. And these are broadly, you find between when the Mughals are ruling, or for that matter, when the imperial power is much more stronger. So he says that when imperial powers are stronger, there is increase in population, there is increase in agricultural area, or for that matter in agrarian production, there is more commercial intensification, and especially in post under the Mughals, that's why you find the spread of the firearms, the gunpowder technology that the Mughals used in their expansion. So he says that technology has had a role to play in this kind of institutional establishment and the institutions becoming much more powerful. And then he says that as an unprecedentedly powerful state that benefited from agrarian expansion, it actually took a much greater shape under the British rule, under the British colonial rule, when this agrarian expansion and the advantage of this agrarian expansion is taken over by the British through the world trade. Now, when he talks about all these larger similarity that he finds in both the exposed zones and the protected zones, because when he talks about these technologies, the imperial powers becoming much more powerful, he says that this is also in some way very much similar to what we find in India and in Eurasia. But then he says that there are three major differences that distinguishes protected zones from the exposed zones. The first difference that we find between the protected and the exposed ones is that whereas in Western and Northern Europe, Japan, or for that matter, even Japan or the Southeast Asian regions, there you have substantially and increasingly shielded kind of a if there is a, some kind of a geographical protection of those regions in comparison to areas such as India or for that matter China. So China, he considers China also in as part of the exposed zones. So he says that these areas of India and China were open to domination by people of the nomadic or semi-nomadic background who were coming from the steppes and the uplands, or they who were coming from the Middle East deserts, or who were coming from the forests of Inner Asia. So throughout much of the period in the second millennium, the Inner Asians directed political developments not only in China but also in South Asia, as well as in Transoxiana, or for that matter in Persia, and especially in India. So that's why you find the rule of the Seljuks, the Mongols, the Mamluks, then the Ottoman took over. So the vulnerability to the Inner Asian occupation is the main criteria of protected zones and exposed zone status being given by Victor Liberman. So when he's talking about the how much vulnerable is the zone for these Inner Asian nomadic or semi-nomadic tribes, then when he's talking about the practical consequences of the exposed zone's vulnerability, for example, obviously India, so and that is much relevant to us when we are talking about the entire Indo-Gangetic basin, and especially the Mid-Ganga and the Lower Ganga basin. What we find that in these areas of Mid-Ganga or Lower Ganga, the political developments were substantially on, substantially done by the Inner Asians, who altered the local trajectories to fit their own requirements. For example, if you look at the history of early centuries, like the early medieval India, it remained divided among the regions, regional states. And there was a possibility that these regional states would expand into a much more permanent type of an empire. But what you find is that just because it was an exposed zone, that after 1200 or from the 13th century period, you have the Turkic invaders coming in from Northwest area. And obviously many of them were of the nomadic background. And they had very easy access to, just because they were coming on horseback from those areas, they, through their cavalry, they introduced a new kind of warfare, which was very novel to this region of Asia, because and at that time the Indian rulers were not exposed to such kind of warfare. So Turkic conquests gave birth to the establishment of the Delhi Sultanate. And they then later on you have the Mughal Empire being established. So the Sultanate and the Mughal success reflected not only the superior cavalry, but the it also talk when it also lets us know about the wider commercial linkages that it established between the Transoxiana Afghanistan and Persia, which was in some way much more efficient than the earlier South Asian practices. So you have the rulers like the Palas in Eastern India who had a connection with South Asia, Southeast Asia, but then this kind of a connection that the Sultanate and the Mughal established with the Persian-Islamic world, it was considered to be much more efficient. So in India, where the inner Asians, the nomadic tribes, they revolutionized the political geography and they modified the elite culture with growing force. They became, in fact, the early and the main catalyst of early modernity. But if you look at the other zones where you have the protect which Lieberman calls as the protected zones, there this kind of an outsiders invasion, the it did not happen because it had a some kind of a geographical barrier around it. In you if in contrast to the protected zones, the inner Asian influence increased markedly during the second millennium BC, and there is no doubt about it. We have seen, in India, we have seen these Sultanate of the Mughals and the British being empire being established. But then, if you look at the take the example of China, even there you have the Mongol Yuan and the Manchu Qing dynasties, which were established in China. The Mughals obviously readily incorporated local elites and they patronized the local traditions. In China, similar situations have similar developments have taken shape. Yet, whereas the Manchus in China, they came from a remote impoverished land and they perforce and adopted Neo-Confucian culture in order to govern China. The Delhi Sultans and the Mughals, they actually they encouraged the Persian-Islamic culture and presented themselves in the official pronouncements as the champions of Islam. So this was also very much distinct from the sources that were written at that time, from the chroniclers who compiled their histories. So this was completely different from the practices that were being followed by majority of the population in these regions. The development of this kind of a Persian culture, Persian Islamic culture, then sometimes it appears in many of the writings that it was enforced on the Hindu majority. However, the very continuation of the Hindu culture, the extensive Hindu culture, it suggests that this was possibly not happening. And, just not with understanding the development of the pan-confessional warrior culture, the moderately successful Muslim culture, and even more extensive the Hindu-Muslim accommodation that we see, both at the elite level and the popular levels, the conquest elites in South Asia challenged and modified the local traditions far more directly than the counterparts in China. So in South Asia, Persian-Islamic culture can be seen as a second charter dispensation comparable to its universal claims, and then the north-south transmission that had happened to Sanskritic Hindu culture in the late first millennium. Although percentage of total population immigration of warrior elites in India may not have been much larger than the Manchus of China, but the Mughals conceded even less power to the non-Muslims than the Manchus according to the Chinese literati. So, in fact, he has questioned the very idea of this kind of a syncretism that many of the historians, mainstream historians, have been talking about. But then a much more emphatic point that Lieberman raises is about the exposed position of these areas because of which the outside invasion had happened. The Mughal experience supports the assumption that he considered to be ethnic and the religious solidarity between the rulers and rules, which he thinks that it was a basic precondition for political effectiveness, and that he finds when the Mughals were ruler. But he says that in these vast exposed zones, the very realm of superiority of the Mughals over the larger majority of Hindu population, it stemmed precisely from their character as small, cohesive, inner Asian conquest elites. So, when he's talking about these two zones, the exposed zones and the protected ones, he's mentioning about the expanding frontiers of France, Russia, or like the countries of Japan, wherein the local people suddenly found themselves subject to the imperial rulers of different ethnicity. But this was an invariable feature of the annexed peripheries. So he says that if you compare this situation with that of Asia, that is India, it differed fundamentally in the sense that from the imposition of ethnicity or culture by small alien conquest elites at the very core of newly created empire, such as that we find in India under the Mughals and the Delhi Sultanate. So this is, it was some kind of an imposed ethnicity and culture that was thrust upon the non-Islamic majority population. So the Mughal patterns originated in the nomadic cavalry culture. It imposed the alien ethnicity and culture at the center of imperial system that they themselves created. It remained a minority of the total imperial population. It favored among their subjects a relatively high degree of ethnic and cultural compartmentalization. And this, despite the fact that there was, there is so much of work that has come up about the syncretic culture. But then he says that there were extremely these externally derived agents of early modern political integration were largely because of this feature of or the characteristics of India as being an exposed zone. The Indo-Gangetic plain, he's very specific about the Indo-Gangetic plain, and he says that these were the first to develop an urban state system, in part because they boasted the productive riverine locales which were capable of supporting large populations and the flora and fauna suitable for domestication, which easily cleared the vegetation and which with its intense local synergies. But he says that this did not preclude their welcoming of the the local crops, the animals, the key technologies, right? So in that sense, their position in India and the arteries of communication, or for that matter, the migration or pastoralism or the trade offered, trade which took place, these offered critical access to the external ideas and material inputs. So the interconnections between the Middle East, the areas of Transoxiana, or for that matter Afghanistan, and the Indo-Gangetic Valley, it facilitated the rapid dissemination across this region for knowledge of crops, or for that matter the domestic animals, and most importantly the writings. And then, of course, the warfare technologies that was brought from that part of Asia. But then when he's talking about the exposed zone of India, he says that not all states in India were that were within the exposed zone category. He says that some of the regions, like you have a region like Assam, which was difficult for the Mughals moving on the horseback to enter into those territories and defeat the Ahoms so easily. So The Indian empires obviously reflected the power of the inner Asian cavalry, the nomadic tribe that was coming from Northwest India or Central Asia. But and it reflected the openness of North China, or for that matter, the Indo-Gangetic Plain, whose internal divisions were less sharp than those geographical features, which actually were so strong in France and countries like Japan or in many of the Eurasian regions, that it became easier for the nomadic tribes to enter into India. So given the dispersal of resources over such vast territories, the imperial population many a times, which was larger than the protected zones, we find that in India and China, we have unusually daunting challenges to stability and penetration. So the Indian empires grew larger and more powerful, and the political evolution in India was far less continuous than in the protected zone states. But obviously, it was also for the same fact that newer nomadic tribes, newer semi-nomadic tribes would come and challenge the earlier nomadic tribes who had established their rule in the exposed zones. So for much of the history of South Asia, it actually oscillated between short-lived periods of comparatively weak unification and long era of polycentricism. So the reason which was one of the prime factors behind establishing such rulerships like the Delhi Sultanate and the Mughals, they were also, the same reason also worked which challenged these rulerships and authorities. So although capable of sweeping initial conquest, neither the Delhi Sultanate nor the Mughal Empire succeeded in preventing the recurrent and, the provincial challenges. So such instabilities ensured that the institutional and dynastic links between successive Indian empires were relatively modest. In comparison, the post-imperial successor states actually showed much considerable vitality, and the regional literary tradition prospered even under the Mughals, and you find that the linguistic and ethnic map of India remained highly fragmented. So overall, the protected zones differed from the exposed zones of India in various ways. Obviously, one of the prime reasons is the geographical openness of the exposed areas of India. The protected zone was not occupied for any substantial period by the inner Asians or the nomadics, whereas in India, you find that the nomadic tribes have dominated the local population here for a substantial period of time. In most of the protected zones, we will find that the realms of modest scale joint sustained interstate competition favored the cultural integration, whereas in exposed zones it has not happened. There is not much of cultural integration, and you find the acceleration of administrative centralization more readily in the protected zones than the exposed zones of India. So, in India, what we find is that when the British come to rule, who were eager to portray themselves as replacing an incompetent Mughal rule, they had no difficulty in seeing, the people saw the British Raj as successor to the Mughal state, because their territories were basically, in effect, were getting reassembled. So similarities were not merely geopolitical. Both the British and the Mughal derived their power from administrative and fiscal logics, which actually originated beyond the subcontinent. And that's why they were, even the British were accepted so easily initially. So in that sense, both Lieberman says that both the Mughals and the British, they revolutionized the military organization and the financial system, the fiscal system, or the administrative system. And they allied with the local commercial interest, who fused the settled society with more mobile forms of wealth. And they introduced the substantially novel linguistic and cultural practices. But, in that sense, they pursued some kind of a very novel program, which did not integrate the local population so extensively. Now, this is something which is questionable, because when we talk about this kind of a non-integration of the local population, it is not very accurate if we read many of the histories and many of the sources that we have for the Mughal period. Because under the Mughal rule, you have integration of many of the local culture, even by the Mughals. So, this kind of vilification of the Mughal rule, or for that matter, the rule of the rulers from coming with a Perso-Islamic culture, is not quite right, which Lieberman claims. Secondly, when he talks about the entire Indo-Gangetic zone as one, in putting it in one category of exposed zone, it is not correct. And if we look at the Mid-Ganga section, it had its own geographical limitation, geographical, boundaries and barriers, which was not very easy for even the powerful Mughals to come and invade these territories and rule these territories easily. So we'll see that in the next section, that what are the characteristics of the Mid-Ganga zone, which in fact is also the answer to our initial question, which I put before you, that why Bakhtiar Khalji preferred to move from Mid-Ganga area and rule in the Bengal Delta. So this was one of the challenges that possibly the early Turkic invaders felt and experienced, that this was the most challenging zone, and it was not very easy zone to rule. Riverine characteristics of Mid-Ganga created its own cultural homogeneity. The form of rule that arose in Mid-Ganga plain carried its own features and characteristics. So it needed to be studied beyond the model of exposed zones as understood by Victor Lieberman. The construction of Bihar as a region took place in early modern times. We will find that the Ganga and its tributaries played the most crucial role in such historical progressions. And, the riverine character of the Mid-Ganga plain, where you have many rivers coming and meeting the Ganga, it went on to create its own cultural homogeneity. So broadly, what we find is there's a similar ecology and culture, Gradually, it gave shape to an administrative region called Bihar. And in that sense, we cannot treat the entire Indo-Gangetic zone into one category of exposed zone. And especially when it comes to the mid-Ganga, we cannot call it an exposed zone, even if we take the definition of an exposed zone being, you know, a zone where you don't have geographical barriers. Mid-Ganga had its own geographical barrier which disallowed the Turkic or the Mongol invasions later on to rule so easily and control the territory so easily.